This is Harrison Reel 2.
My maiden name was Lucas, L-U-C-A-S, which is Luca in French and Lucas in German. It's a name which is not typically Jewish at all, could be of any nationality, and certainly it's not typically Jewish. And on the 10th of May 1940, when the Germans invaded Belgium, the Belgian authorities immediately arrested all German nationals. And they came. We lived on the 8th floor of a block of flats, and on the 4th floor lived an immigrant German Jewish family whose name I forget, but they had a very, very German Jewish name. And the Belgians arrived there with a, not with a van. Yes, they came with a van to arrest these people. Because to the Belgians, a German was a German. I mean, the fact that the German Jews were really the very first victims right from the beginning, you know, everybody else was the victim of the Germans 7 years after the German Jews had already been sitting in concentration camps, emigrating and all the rest of it. This was not seen. One was German, period. And these people were being arrested. And I remember standing at the window watching these people being put into a van, and I saw the woman whom I knew, who lived on the fourth floor, turning around to one of these Belgians and said, "Why do you arrest us? Why don't you arrest the people upstairs, Luca, on the eighth floor?" And whether they had gone by the sort of German-sounding Jewish names of these people, why they had no record of us, because we were registered as German nationals, I don't know. Anyway, all of us, we were all arrested as a result of this woman. And they had come with a van to arrest this particular family, or a car, and they didn't have room for us. There were four in her family, and I had a brother, and my father and mother, there were four of us. Whereupon they marched us to the Maison Communale, which is the town hall of Saint-Gilles, which is the famous prison of Saint-Gilles, is nearby there, where many resistors were later imprisoned, which was a walk of about, I should think, a mile, up a very long, straight street, which I took every day to go to school before I went to this secretarial college. And we were marched down this street with a couple of policemen, and people spat at us from the windows. By the time I got to this Hotel de Ville, I was dripping with spit because we were Germans, we were enemies, and you could not explain. And it is not very nice. And then we were in a sort of large hall. All the people sat there together, and one was very depressed. Nothing much had happened on that day. One bomb had been dropped very early in the morning at Place Madou on the boulevard, and but I think that was all, nothing else. All the rest was rumors, and one listened to the radio, and nothing happened in Brussels, apart from the fact that German nationals were arrested. And late in the afternoon, my mother and I were freed, and we went home. And my brother, who was 15, and my father were not freed. My late on that afternoon of the 4th, of the 10th of May, the British troops started arriving, driving in their trucks towards the German-Belgian border. And I had one stood in the street, and the lorries were, the trucks were going by very fast, and one wanted to shake hands with them. One put one's hand out, and they put their hands out. And I got my wrist dislocated, because you can imagine, you know, all these hand clubs, and there must have been hundreds of people who had very sore wrists on that day. And I don't know, I took it all so lightly. I don't know where my mother was. After all, we'd just been released from this detention thing in the early afternoon. Anyway, my brother came back on the following day, and my father just vanished. He wasn't freed. Then on the 14th of the 14th of May, people started leaving Brussels. Because obviously the news was bad and the Germans were getting closer, and by that time one had heard what had happened in Rotterdam, and that by that time Holland had already surrendered, and so my mother, my brother and I decided to go to France with everybody else. I mean, the refugees were getting ready. And we left by train to the French border. We got as far as Tournai. Tournai is T-O-U-R-N-A-I. Is a largish town in Belgium, very near the French border. And we spent one night there. It was absolutely packed. I don't remember. We spent a night in all three of us in one bed of, I don't know, I think we slept on the floor. I don't remember exactly. And very, very early the next morning, my brother must have got up about 3 or 4 in the morning, and he came into the room at 5 o'clock in the morning and said, "Come on, we're going. We're getting out of here. This town is going to be bombed." My brother was 15 years old. My mother said, "A lot of rubbish, and where have you got this news from?" And, but on the other hand, my mother was a very easily subdued woman, and she was... a man was always right, and this was the only man in her family, this 15-year-old boy. She didn't know where her husband had disappeared to. And so we said, "Well," my brother said, "we must get out of here," and we got out. And I said to my brother, "Why? What?" He said, "Look, I've watched the fire brigade has got out. I saw lots of diplomatic cars. They're all getting out. And if they go, we go." So we walked towards the border on roads that were crowded with the photographs you always see with people with their cars, and they could, many cars loaded up to the top. And about, was it 3 or 4 miles from the border, it was completely at a standstill. It was not moving at all, but we were walking. So because we walked, we were getting along further than the rest of the people who were literally stationary. It was a very, very hot day. It was the most beautiful month of May. It wasn't the No, Hitler had invaded because he had a weather forecast, and he always attacked on a Friday in any case, because he had soothsayer. I mean, he was a very superstitious man. And the weather was fantastic. And we walked to the border. And when we got there, we didn't know until afterwards that the Maginot Line had been breached. We had no idea about this. And the border was still, I think it was still open to people. It slowed down a lot. But we were asked to show our identity papers. And we had cards saying German. This was on the 16th of May. It was something I'll never forget. And before we reached the border, it was the middle of the day, it was very hot, and we were sitting on the side of the road. My mother always wore high heels. My mother had no shoes with flat heels. My mother was a very elegant woman, and she really had no shoes with flat heels. And, you know, and I'm sure she wasn't the only one. And walking along the roads, the dusty roads, and in May 1940 on high heels, you know, the mind boggles. And we saw Tournai being bombed. The whole place was Tournai. The center of Tournai has a huge big cathedral. It was towers, and it was very, very spectacular. And My brother was vindicated. My mother was very impressed with my brother's. It must have been a sheer coincidence. I don't know. How could he have known? But he was dead right. It was bombed that day. Anyhow, we continued walking. We got to the border, and because of our identity cards, we were turned back. And this was really quite a nightmare. So we started walking back on this road, passing all the cars, waiting to get into France. And every single car we passed for I think, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours, it was horrible. The people said, "Why are you coming back? Is the border closed? Why are you coming back?" And the answer was always, "No, the border isn't closed." "Well, why are you coming back then?" Well, you couldn't say because we're Germans. It was a real nightmare. It was horrible. From car to car to car, the same question, the same answer, and there was no answer to the last question. And then we stopped at a little roadside cafe, which had run out of everything. They had a glass of water. We were sitting there, and they had the radio on. And there was listening to France, to French broadcast. Now, whether this was Albert Lebrun was the president of France at the time. I don't remember who made this speech, but we came in on the middle of it, and this is the first time that we realized that things were going very badly for France, because one had never expected things to go well for Belgium and Holland, but one had expected the war in France to be a repetition of World War I, and France would resist, and they would never get to Paris, and it had never occurred to anybody, of course, that France could not resist it. And there was this speech and by this French politician, and it ended by saying that it was either Foch or Clemenceau, I'm not sure of this, possibly Clemenceau, who had said on his deathbed, "Si la France est en danger, appelez Weygand. La France vient de l'appeler." I never forget that voice. It means that Clemenceau said on his deathbed, "If France is in danger, call for Weygand." France has just called on him. And this made it clear to us that France was in danger. We then got, I don't know where we spent the night. Somehow, I really don't remember whether we went by train or walked. We ended up at La Panne. La Panne is a little seaside town, the last town before the French border. In other words, just about next to Dunkirk. And we got stuck there. It was absolutely full of refugees. We had a room at the top of a hotel. And I became very ill. I've never discovered why or how. I had a roaring temperature for days with no other symptoms whatsoever. And it went again. I've never discovered what this was. It's very, very strange. No medicine, nothing. But I was almost delirious for days. And we were stuck there with everybody else. And one day, must have been on the 27th or the 28th, the 28th of May, King Leopold III capitulated. Of course, we didn't know that. But on the 28th, or possibly on the 29th, we came across some Belgian soldiers who were coming back, and I'll never forget this. This was a Belgian soldier. He was wearing carpet slippers. He must have had very sore feet and discarded his boots. Anyhow, it struck me to see this soldier in full uniform with carpet slippers. And he said, as far as he was concerned, the war was finished. The war was over. And people said, "How can you say that, and how disgusting, and what are you?" And and that was, must have been on the 28th or the 29th, but we didn't know the king had capitulated. And on the night of the 31st of May to the 1st of June, the Germans obviously got very close. It was really the Dunkirk thing, which we knew nothing about. We didn't know. Dunkirk was a little town like La Panne. It hadn't acquired any sort of name. It stands for something else now, doesn't it? I mean, the word Dunkirk isn't the name of a town anymore. It's become an expression of what happened there. We didn't know anything about this. We didn't know the British were getting out. We knew nothing. And we only knew that the bombing came closer and closer. And that night we were being bombed to smithereens. So all the people in this hotel where we stayed ended up in the cellar where we spent the whole night. And we then discovered that there were two cannons, the British had in that area, in that town. And in order to make it sound as though they had many, to mislead the enemy, they moved this truck. They had a gun, or at least one gun. I mean, as I say, I only saw the wheels through the window of the sort of grill of the cellar. They had them on the back of a lorry, and they moved this lorry, and sort of were able to shoot at the Germans from various places, which made the Germans think, hopefully, that it was very well defended, which of course it wasn't. So we had one direct hit on the house, whereupon I said, "Well, that's it." One had always heard that a bomb never falls twice in the same place. And then, of course, suddenly these wheels stopped in front of the cellar and this thing started shooting. So, my God, we're going to get another one. Anyhow, we survived. Everybody survived in the cellar. And the next morning we got out and the Germans walked in. And there was only one thing to do, go back to Brussels. And we started walking, and the road was littered with British material and clothes and uniforms and dead horses. And as it was, I said, it was very hot that whole month, and the horses must have been lying there for quite a while, and some of them had already burst. And it was terrible. Stomach had, swollen and burst. Strange things happened. My brother and I were walking ahead of my mother with her high heels on the way back. And we passed a horse, which was lying, it was a long road, and was almost very depressed. We didn't speak to one another. And the roads were empty then. It wasn't like the going, the going away, the coming back was different. And there was this horse lying there with its back towards us. And as we passed it, we turned around and looked. And this horse had burst, and it was a terrible mess. And we didn't say a word to each other, my brother and I, we just walked on. My mother was a few, sort of 10, 20 yards behind. And of course, when she passed the horse, she also looked around. And she became quite hysterical. She started shouting. I said, "Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me not to look? And how could you have let me look at this horse?" And this is the sort of thing that is always stuck in our mind. And we always said to each other, we said, "Look," we said to her afterwards, "if we'd asked you not to look, you would have looked anyway. I mean, this is one of these things." And it became almost a family joke. We always used to say, "It's the birthday of the horse on the road to Furne," you know?
On the road to?
Furne, Furnes. Which has now been changed into I don't know what, because that was the French name for it, and it's now called something else, and I don't know what. Which is not far from Ypres, which is now spelled Ieper, I think. It was then called Ypres, Wipers. And we spent a night in a sort of convent. Anyhow, somehow we got back to Brussels after a few days or a week. Went back to the flat, still no news, nothing, no news at all of my father. And in a way, life was almost normal then. There was a sort of normality about it. One didn't go to school. I don't remember what we did during that summer. And the first few days, then of course Paris fell. But life was normal in Brussels. It had passed us, the Germans were there, they were very polite. They were beginning to, I mean, nothing was happening. Nobody was being beastly to anybody, as long as you didn't do anything out of, you know, didn't show your animosity towards the Germans. And the King's Palace had a swastika flag flying in the middle, and one sort of made the sort of childish attempts. We used to walk a long way around. We never took a shortcut past the King's Palace for any reason whatsoever, because one just did not want to pass in front of the King's Palace as long as it had the swastika. And then there was one very interesting thing. There was a war memorial set in a wall near the Palais de Justice I was talking about earlier, where two soldiers stood side by side, a British, a Tommy, and a Belgian soldier, a bronze sort of relief plaque. Life size, with soldiers resting their chins on their guns for World War I. And this statue was covered in fresh flowers every single day in 1940, until the Germans stopped it and put a guard there, and it then became forbidden to put flowers there, and then quite often early in the morning there was still the odd bunch, which the Germans then removed. This was constant for months and months and months. It was the one way that people could prove to one another that, you know, that one was pro-Allied.
You said that the Germans were polite as long as people didn't show animosity, but do you recollect instances of animosity to them?
Oh, yes, right from the beginning. In the meantime, of course, Italy had attacked France, and just obviously before France capitulated, and then the Italians went into Greece, where they got a terrible hiding from the Greeks, and the university students of Brussels, for instance. The university in Brussels is called l'Université Libre de Bruxelles, which is the letters are ULB, and the students used to wear their caps and their which said ULB, with the L turned upside down, which made it look like a, is the word gibbet? You know, like a hanging thing.
Yes.
And by just wearing that L upside down, it made it perfectly obvious what it was. One of these little things. Then children, for some reason or other, started saying, "If you're pro-British, wear a safety pin in your buttonhole." And we were all Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, etc. And we all had these large safety pins from camping, you know, which you use for these very large pins. And in no time at all, you couldn't get one of these large pins anywhere in Brussels, so then people resorted to ordinary safety pins. And if you wore a safety pin in your lapel, it meant you were pro-British. Little silly thing. And of course, the moment the Germans got wise to that, that was forbidden. And then when the Italians were getting this frightful beating by the Greeks for quite a long time, the university students staged a little protest. They marched down the Avenue Louise in Brussels. At that time had many trees and many walkways. Nowadays it's quite different, and it was a bit like the Champs-Élysées of Brussels. And a number of students formed themselves into a large V for victory, put an uncooked piece of macaroni into a black tied ribbon into their buttonholes, and walked in a V shape with their heads bent and their hands in their pockets as though they were following a funeral, all the way up the Avenue Louise. Little thing like that, of course, everybody smiled. It did an awful lot for morale. These little pointless things were, they were very good for morale. They kept one going. And there were lots of little signs like that already from the beginning. Now, I forgot to say that in 1939, when the war started, I was a Girl Guide, and the Girl Guide and Boy Scout movement, because of its founder, Lord Baden-Powell, was, of course, a hotbed. It was a sort of tailor-made for the future resistance. I mean, many, many people in occupied Europe who had been in the Boy Scout movement became resistors. And in Belgium, the leader of the, not of the entire Red Cross, La Croix-Rouge de la Jeunesse, was the Red Cross for youth, was the, he was also the head of the Boy Scout movement, and his name was Louis Picaloza. And I, in September 39, when the war started and Belgium was still free, and then I had to go to the Secretarial College, I started going to the Belgian Red Cross to help out with odd duties, and don't remember exactly what that time one did. Because after May 1940, when we had come back from La Panne, I went back to the Red Cross, and then Louis Picaloza had become chief of the Service des Décès, which was the Red Cross service set up to deal with all the people who had been killed, civilians and military, during this 18-day campaign in Belgium. And there was also a prisoner of war service for, because the entire army had, of course, been taken prisoner, and people, you know, food parcels and this kind of thing. People brought their food parcels to the Red Cross to be sent to Germany. And there were many people coming back by then, Belgians who had got as far as France and the south of France, and who were now coming back because France was also occupied. And this stream of refugees went on for months, of course. We got back very quickly because we hadn't got very far. And the Red Cross was dealing with all this, and they had many different services. And the Red Cross then could not cope anymore in its own building, which was quite a new building, but had expanded to all sorts of other private requisition buildings. And they needed someone to communicate from one to the other, and there was no petrol, and they had no cars. And they had a motorcyclist, whose name I forget, and he was the courier from one Red Cross service to another. And he was the first man who introduced me to the resistance. I don't remember exactly how. I don't even remember whom he introduced me to, but he was the first man I talked to. And when one, you see, the word resistance was really, one resisted, but the word résistance became also, it wasn't now, it was a word with a small r, not as it is now, with a capital R. And many people in the Red Cross were very pro-British. Many spoke English. It grew from talking to one another, from testing one another's reaction, I should think. From one was careful, and yet the people one knew well before the war, sometimes perhaps one wasn't careful enough. So you know, in May 1940, I went back to the Red Cross. I've lost my way. I think I got stuck somewhere.
Well, you were talking about the role of, you started by talking about the role of the Scouts and the Red Cross
Yes.
in the resistance. But could I ask you a question at this point about the other side of Belgian feeling? Because so far you've been talking about acts of resistance or pro-Allied feeling. How much pro-German feeling or apathy was there on the part of the population?
You know, it's very difficult to gauge because amongst my own circle of friends, nobody collaborated. Everybody was pro-British. I didn't come across these people. One didn't, after May 1940, one didn't make new friends. One knew the people one had known before. That's the way it feels today. I mean, I can't remember anybody whom I knew in the early 1940s in Belgium whom I hadn't known in the 1930s. One stuck to one's own schoolmates, playmates. As I said, my parents' friends were Jewish refugees. All the men at that time had still, this was between May and September, the men had disappeared. One didn't know where they'd gone to, and I'll come to that just now. And the women and children were there and were very lost, didn't know how to manage. I mean, I don't think my mother had ever written out a check. I don't know how, as a matter of fact, I don't know how during these few months until my father suddenly turned up on our doorstep in early September. I think my father had probably arranged for us to have a certain amount of cash and that we managed to live with this, on this cash for 3 months. I don't know, I have no idea. And in early September, my father suddenly turned up. He had been deported together with all other German nationals, Jews, non-Jews, German nationals, to the south of France, to a camp called Gurs, G-U-R-S, at a place called Saint-Cyprien, which is now a tourist attraction. Was La Grande Motte, which is, you might have heard of La Grande Motte, which is a holiday resort near the Spanish border on the Riviera. And this was literally a concentration camp. People go on holiday there. They have no idea that this used to be a concentration camp. That camp had been established by the French to deal with all the refugees from the Spanish Civil War who were crossing the border in the 1936-37 period. And this camp existed. It was standing there empty, and it was ready to receive the next batch of people. And this is how all the German nationals from Belgium, possibly from France, I don't know, but all the people who were deported there from Belgium stayed in this camp, where conditions were appalling, where there was no way of boiling water, where many people died of typhoid and many people had dysentery. And my father decided to escape from there, and did, literally. I don't know whether it was barbed wire. Somehow he came back. He went to Vichy, sold his gold watch. Somehow, one morning, he turned up in Brussels. And it was then decided, he must have decided then and there, this was just a question of time. He had to sell everything he possibly could, realize as much of his funds as possible, because we had to get out of there, and go back to unoccupied France, where he had just been, and he realized the difference. The thing was to get into unoccupied France, which, of course, at that time, one thought would remain unoccupied forever, with the idea of crossing into Switzerland from unoccupied France, because there, crossing the border didn't present the same danger, and especially with a wife with high heels and two children. And so I went to... Well, then I said to my father, I've done my stint at Secretarial College. I did what you wanted me to do, and there was no question of earning my living. And then I don't know why, but I was 17. He didn't want me to go to an office. And I said, well, I want to go to art school. And that is when I went to my first art school. This school was an old abbey, which was a sunken abbey in the center of Brussels in a park. And it was the tram stop to go to school was the same tram stop as the one for Gestapo headquarters. And we had 2 hours for lunch. We left school at 12, went home, and came back at 2 o'clock, which meant that every single day I had to take 4 trams full of Gestapo people. And not so much in the morning, but definitely at lunchtime. And I said to my teacher, I said, well, this is awful. At 12 o'clock, I have to take the tram going back. But at 2 o'clock, from now on, I'm going to be late. I'd rather come a few minutes late and get onto an empty tram. And they agreed to this, and I did that. And one day, I went back to school at about 2:05 on a very empty tram. And we had developed, at that time, we were so not frightened. Things hadn't got so bad for Jews, not in Belgium. And my father had said to us, if anybody asks you for a direction in the street, don't pretend you don't speak German, because if they ask for your identity card, they can see that you